Shrink Wrap Radio number 424, Being a Brainwise Therapist with Dr. Bonnie Badenoch.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, author of three books and In the Trenches therapist, supervisor, teacher, who has spent the last 10 years integrating the discoveries of neuroscience into the art of psychotherapy. For more information about Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, thank you very much, David. I'm delighted to be here.
And I am delighted to have you here, I must say. Let me start out by saying how very impressed I am by your book, Being a Brainwise Therapist, and accompanying the book, your Brain Savvy Therapist Workbook. And these two things, either one of them alone is a tour de force. And the fact that you've written these two volumes, I can't tell you how impressed I am.
Well, thank you.
Well, you've mastered an incredible amount of information, but I think in your workbook, you've also created the path for other therapists to follow and to get some of this extensive information about the brain under their own belts.
Well, that was certainly my wish with the second book in particular, a kind of a pathway from the beginning of therapy through transition, but also to provide in the first six chapters of the book a pathway for us to pursue our own healing as well.
Yes, yes. You know the old joke, how do you eat an elephant? And the punchline, of course, is one bite at a time. But I have to ask you, how were you able to master all this information about the brain and then how to apply it to psychotherapy?
Well, I had the extraordinary good fortune to get to be in Dan Siegel's study group for 5 years.
Wow.
And what I discovered in being part of that wonderful group was that Dan went over a lot of the same information again and again, because I don't think you get any of this in one pass or maybe even 10. But over the years of being there, it began to not only get into kind of a left hemisphere understanding, but began to really change how I saw the world. It began to become more embodied. And so I think that was hugely helpful to have the repetition.
No problem. As I say, I'm sure it was. I had the opportunity to interview Dan, I think 2 or 3 years ago, but I haven't had that repetition, although I've interviewed other people and I'm hearing a lot of this information, you know, over and over again, but I still have a lot to absorb, but go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, and then the applications part, I was a clinical director at a nonprofit organization in Orange County, California at the time, and I had about 10 interns, and we walked together through this information as how it would direct us in being and support us in being with our clients. We work almost exclusively with severe trauma and what are called access to personality disorders at our agency. And so we found this so amazingly supportive that we began to be able to craft ways to use it and apply it. And that has been my passion about this, is the applications part.
Yeah, and I just love what you've done with that and that you took it so to heart. I think that many people, the information would have just kind of washed over them and maybe not necessarily changed how they work so extensively, but you have really wrestled with the material, and as a person who's in the trenches, you've really made it practical, and that's one of the things that really excites me about your work.
Well, thank you. It changed. It supported some things we were doing, refined others, and then gave us a whole new take on a lot of areas. And I think regardless of whatever paradigm we might work out of as a therapist, there's so much here that can support optimal ways of collaborating with the brain's natural healing processes if we can really put together what we are doing now and what's possible with this new information that's coming.
Yeah. I referred earlier to the elephant, and unfortunately we don't have the time here to eat the whole elephant, but let's dig in and take some bites right now. Early on, you write that there are four principles that guide your therapeutic work, and I'd like to have you just kind of touch on them lightly because they'll probably come up later in our discussion. But one is neural integration. Number two is right brain to right brain connection between therapist and patient. Number three, therapist health. And number four, empathic awareness.
Yep,
so let's start with neural integration.
Yes. Well, again, this builds very strongly on Dan Siegel's work with the nine domains of integration and helping us to understand which parts of the brain need to be connected to which parts in order for us to have well-being and be capable of empathic relatedness and generally have good lives. So he was a wonderful guide about that. And then working also with Alan Shore's work, understanding more and more deeply what happens that these key areas don't become integrated when there has been attachment loss or trauma or anything like that. And so as we can begin to see and as we listen to our clients what is connected and what isn't, I think it can really guide us not so much with specific intervention, but with ways to be with our clients that support their brain's natural capacity to integrate.
And that probably leads into the second one here, right brain to right brain connection between therapist and patient.
Absolutely. All of our relational circuitry is rooted in the right hemisphere. The left hemisphere reprocesses information, but it doesn't have this core relational circuitry rooted there. Not that the whole brain doesn't fire for everything, but the roots of it are in the right. So if we want to connect with our clients in a way that supports them being able to open and move toward what it is that they need to be present to in order to heal it, we really need to both ourselves and them be in this more right hemisphere orientation. And as we do that, they're able to resonate with us and it helps them move more deeply into these very circuitry where the injuries are held. So it's a crucial part. And man, our culture these days pushes so hard toward the left hemisphere that this has become probably the center of my work, is even understanding what this means, really, as well as being able to be there ourselves in spite of the left-shifted pull of the culture.
Yes, and when you talk about being able to be there ourselves, I think that flows into the third building block here, therapist health.
Yes. Yes, I'm in my 70s now, and for the rest of my career, my aim is to help more and more therapists be able to heal whatever woundedness they may be carrying in terms of attachment patterns and implicit memory that keeps us from being as present with as few judgments and as open as we can be. We all have been wounded. There's no one who hasn't been. And those wounds, when they get tangled up with our clients' wounds, our patients' wounds, then we wind up in a position where it's very hard for us to be as available as we want to be for them. So these days we're doing longer-term retreat kinds of experiences to help therapists really deepen into their own inner world so that they can be as available as possible, not only for their patients, but also for their families, you know.
Sure, sure. I'm also in my 70s, it happened, so I'm not going to be able to play the age card here.
There we go. No, you're not.
I was going to say, oh, I can't master all of this stuff.
It's a nice decade.
You've blown me out of the water here. Your fourth one is empathic awareness, and I think that also relates to what you were just saying.
Yeah, it does, and I think the way I've said it in the book and way I think about it is of trying to be as aware each moment of what is the most empathic way I can be present to my patients in this moment. And that depends on where they are developmentally in that moment, what part of their inner world they're touching. Are they in an infant state? Are they more in a teenage state? Are they more needing some support in more adult state of mind? And so being able to resonate with them and get a sense of what might flow out empathically that would meet them right where they are seems to me the way we create safety in the room and the way that the person can move most deeply into the places they need to go.
In the questions that I've crafted here, I'm using the word patient rather than client or some other designation, and I'm following your lead in the book so that no listener jumps on us for doing this. Maybe you can share your rationale for favoring the word patient.
Yes, you know, I struggled so much in writing the book of whether to say client or patient, and I really sat with the words for a long time. I generally use the word client. If I could, I would use courageous people, but it gets cumbersome because that's how I see the people who come here, these courageous people who are willing to begin to really touch into what's painful for them. But having to choose between client and patient also means someone who bears with suffering without complaining and is willing to move through suffering with patience. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, and I say it at the beginning of the book so that people will understand why I use that. Client, I realized, can sound more like, you know, somebody who hires me as a coach and pays me dough, and it just didn't feel right. But again, I would much rather be able to say courageous person.
Yes, yes, I really like that. Now, your book is divided into two main sections, and part one is titled Theoretical Foundations, and part two is titled Practical Matters. Before diving into the theoretical foundations, I love the way you set up the technical discussion that follows, and I'd like to read a brief quote in which you say, and I quote, "To this end, we're going to weave a tapestry with the warp of science-based discoveries and the woof of subjective experience and intuitive art, reaching toward a coherent paradigm that will encourage neural integration through the power of knowledge and compassionate relationship." That really captures something that you do throughout the book, which is to combine science with subjective knowing, intuition, and compassion. And wow, that's quite a feat, and it's also a mission that I'm on in my interview series here.
Wonderful.
Well, you go
I think if we can't get it in, if we can't have the, again, the felt sense of relatedness side by side with the knowledge, it's only half. And if we can have both, then we have this whole-brained way that leads with the right hemisphere relationship, but has the support of the understanding. And I just feel what I've come to understand in these last 10 years of being with all this is that that's the most supportive combination, both for therapist mental health, but also for, of course, for our patients, our courageous people.
Yes, yes. Now, you go on to discuss in some detail the brain's building blocks covering, something just popped into my mind that I wanted to mention. Just this morning in the paper, they announced three Nobel Prize winners who have done work on the brain, studying an area of the hippocampus that allows us to navigate physically through the world, to kind of remember how to get from here to there. So that's just another piece of the puzzle, you know, that's kind of hot off the press.
Which is very interesting to me because I have several people whose hippocampi would have been damaged by the level of abuse they have. And one woman, when she steps out of her office, doesn't even know whether to turn right or left to go to the bathroom after being in the building for 5 years.
Wow. Wow.
That just really sparked something in my mind. Yeah.
Yeah. And the thing that blows my mind is that the hippocampus is a relatively small area of the brain, and yet it seems to be so pivotal and to carry such a load in relation to memory everything I read about memory, the hippocampus keeps popping up.
Yeah, and the amygdala is even smaller and has even an even bigger impact that we might speak to.
Yeah. So as I was saying, you go into some detail about the brain's building blocks, and you cover such topics as neural pruning, neural nets, neural plasticity, the various structures and regions of the brain, including the limbic region, the cerebral cortex, the differing functions of the two hemispheres, and the autonomic nervous system. I might be tempted to ask you to go take us through all that, but I don't think we have time to go through all the details here. But it might raise the question for some therapists out there, why do I have to know all that stuff? I'm already an effective therapist, and this just seems like window dressing.
I can really understand that. It can be very daunting in some way, you know, to face all of this, especially if we try to learn it alone. In the workbook, there's a suggestion to do it with a listening partner, and that seems to help more than anything, is to go through this with someone else, so that you can deepen into it relationally. It is interpersonal neurobiology, and to do it interpersonally is really supportive. But what I'd like to do, you'd ask me to pick a small section of the book that I would share that, yes, I particularly like. And I think this helps to answer the question you're asking. So it says, a young woman shivering with fear and sorrow sits across from me, talking about yelling repeatedly at her two young children. She had promised herself she would never do that because she had suffered so much from the rage that ricocheted around her home as a child. The sight of her eyes rooted to the floor and her chest collapsing in on itself in this embodiment of shame touches me. After a few words of understanding, I begin to talk with her about how her brain had wired in this angry response to frustration from the time she was a baby. I speak softly of neural nets and triggers, of the speed of her limbic circuits compared with the slow deliberation of the prefrontal cortex, of neural integration being blocked by the emotional trauma of her childhood, of how working to integrate her brain would change her responses. I say, it's not your fault. I tell her this isn't meant to make an excuse, but is simply the truth about how our brains work. As I talk, she gradually lifts out of her shame and is able to meet my eyes. I have found that sharing at the right empathic moment where it can really land, sharing some words about brain function, is the best way to diminish shame in people as they begin to understand that they're doing the best that they can. And boy, once shame is off the table, there is a way that the connection can be made, because when a person is sunk deep in shame, they're lost to the relationship. They're heading toward what Steve Porges would say is the dorsal vagal, a collapsed, dissociated state, and they can't be in relationship in that state. And so when this information can help people lift out of the shame and make the connection, then we can move ahead with the healing process. So that's one piece. The other piece is that I think, as I've understood more deeply about how our early experiences in particular shape us, that I really do have not only the words of we're doing the best we can, but a really strong felt sense that has dramatically reduced judgments in me, that everybody who comes to me has very sound reasons for doing what they do, even when what they're doing is, we would say, horrible, given their neurobiology and also the level of support they have in this moment. So that allows me to be there with increased compassion, and allows them then to, again, not feel blamed or shamed, but really we can begin to resonate with compassion for these wounded parts of themselves. And then the other piece is that when we begin to talk about the brain, what I see in my courageous people is that they take that home and they begin to become observers of their own brain processes and body brains, including the brains in the belly and the heart and all of that. And as they do that, that in and of itself is regulating. They begin to have the capacity to have a sense of what's going on within them from a caring observer place, just by having a bit of this information, again, delivered at the right empathic moment so it really lands. So, and I could go on and on, but those are some ways that I've seen it be tremendously helpful.
Yeah, that's a really complete answer. And in the midst of that answer, you said something about that you made a shift where you were able to see people more compassionately. And I wonder if you can say something about what brought about that shift.
Well, again, over time, and, you know, studying with Dan and doing an immersion class with Dan, actually, where we had to read all of The Developing Brain, which is not an easy book. The Developing Mind, which is not an easy book. And we didn't know which, and then we were going to teach it to him. So coming out of a history of shame myself, it became very important to me to not look like an idiot in front of Dan. So I really got a chance to go through that and learn what was in that book deeply. And I think that that began to help me really sense, as the people were in front of me, that this man came in and had shaken his child. And, you know, the instant response is to want to protect the child and think, how could you do that to your baby? But what I could sense was almost immediately following that would come a curiosity about, what must have happened to you that you did that? Mm-hmm. And I would soften and open, and I could feel how that would resonate with the person. And then they could open with me about their history and all of that. And we could move forward together with an understanding that this was the best this man could do. And he was being a hero. He was here with me, you know, looking for help so that it wouldn't happen again.
And would that be an example of right brain to right brain communication?
I think so, because the left brain awareness then supports this opening to compassion, which is a whole brain experience, but certainly rooted in the right hemisphere. And that resonance that we could then have is a right hemisphere embodied kind of thing that transfers itself from my body to his body and allows him to feel less shamed and more understood, and then makes him more available to doing the work that's needed so he never shakes his child again.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned working so closely with Dan Siegel, and I think in the book you give him credit for what you characterize, or he characterizes, as 9 pathways of integration.
Yeah.
And certainly there's not time to go through all of them here. One of the most interesting to me was the 9th one, which you characterize as transpirational integration.
Yeah, those are actually Dan's words for that stage of development. And it's it comes out of increasingly healing whatever attachment losses we've had and releasing whatever traumas until we get to a fairly secure and balanced state. And then I think maybe largely coming out of some of Dan's own personal experience, there's this sense that he has that there's a step beyond that where we begin to sense our oneness and connectedness with everything, not as an idea, but as a felt sense in the body. And I think transpirational is a word he coined to mean breathing across, that we breathe across into the lives of others. And I have found that in doing this work, I have very long-term clients because I work with severe trauma, and I've had the luxury my whole career of being able to see people for as long as necessary, and I love that. So I've had this experience of watching their spiritual lives begin to open as we move through the traumas, and they come to the other side, and they begin to have this broad compassion for everyone, which is just such a beautiful thing to see emerge out of these deepest wounds. And I've often thought that the most wounded people may be capable of the greatest degree of health and compassion if they can only have the support to actually move through enough of this terrible pain that they've experienced.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that actually reminds me of a discussion that I had recently with a Jungian analyst, Donald Kalshed, where he was talking about trauma and some of the dimensions that can open up.
It's quite amazing to me, and it just happens. We know that the brain is open to continual integration as part of its being a complex system. And so as a person has sufficient support, the brain seems to find its way toward the next paths. And I, again, just love supporting that.
Mm-hmm. Now, you had the incredible nerve to take on the age-old question of the relationship between brain and mind, and that's really taking a big bite out of the elephant. What's your take on this age-old question?
Well, again, a lot of what's in the book is stolen from Dan with his permission. He was actually my consultant on creating a handbook for my interns, so we got a huge grant to do. And so I got to have him as consultant, and that became the first book ultimately. So out of his experience of working with people in all different fields to try to define this, they were able to come to an agreement that about something that I think I would characterize this way. And that is that the brain is a thing, the embodied brain. It's neural connections that are capable of changing and all of that. But the mind itself may be actually a process, that the mind is how we attend. And boy, this ties in with something maybe we'll talk about later with Ian McGilchrist's work on the two hemispheres.
Yes.
But that the mind, as we focus our attention, wherever that might be, on pain or on you know, healing or wherever we're focusing it, it causes neural firing to happen. And that the mind may be more like a verb and a process that goes on all the time. So I really just took that straight from Dan and then have develop that in a way so that we don't have to be having an ongoing conversation about it so much, because coming at it any other way doesn't seem to get us anywhere.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's I really love your rendering of Dan's work, and I'm sure he would be very happy with it as well. One of the things that you write about quite a bit in the book is inner community, and maybe you can give us a sense of what you mean when you say inner community. And you talk about some guiding principles that you bring to your work there. Can you help us with that a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. This is something that actually, again, I'm a great borrower. I had pretty rugged childhood. And when I finally got some good therapy in my 40s, I actually had a therapist who intuitively seemed to know about the multiple selves inside of us, having nothing to do with multiple personalities, just that we develop multiple selves.
Sure.
So in the process of my work with him, I got a really good felt sense of the different parts of me. And then in the process of studying with Dan and others and learning about how we actually form when we're young, it made all the sense in the world to me that we aren't a single self, but we're really a community that's often formed out of dyads inside. So here I am, I'm a baby, and I'm looking to my mom, and here is this warm and smiling face coming toward me, you know. And so I'm having my own felt sense experience of that oxytocin, my body's relaxing, I feel a sense of warmth and goodness. And at the same time, I'm encoding that experience in my own brain, my embodied brain. I am also, through mirror neuron resonance and the associated circuits, also encoding my mother's response, what she's feeling. So through that resonance, we encode things like her embodied state, her emotional state, and her intention in that moment. And through the senses, we're also encoding what she looks like, smells like, if I'm a baby, what she tastes like, what she sounds like, all of these sensory pieces. So we're importing others into our system all the time. And they're imported as a single neural net with us, because what fires together, wires together. So there's my experience, and my mother's experience in that moment become a single neural net held inside. And this dyad then, because it's filled with pleasant, wonderful experiences, integrates throughout the brain and becomes the inner support for my healthy life.
Okay. And certainly there are a lot of therapeutic approaches that divide us up into various inner parts, or that, you know, that kind of explore this.
I would say they don't divide us up into inner parts so much as they recognize that's really how we are. I mean, that's how we're built.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a good clarification.
That's how we're built. You know, right. We're built that way. And my goodness, I found it so helpful for myself and everybody else when we can go toward an inner pair like that. It's also regulatory, because we're not activating so much neural territory all at once. We're able to focus on a little less territory, and in that way, we're able to have a little more regulation around the pain that's arising.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, something that you write about beautifully is the mutuality of the therapeutic relationship. So tell us about that mutuality, if you will.
Well, I think one of the things that I am very dedicated to helping all of us therapists recognize is that we bring our own attachments, our own implicit memories, our whole self into this endeavor, that it's a completely a two-person system, and that the way that we're able to hold ourselves and hold others together involves this kind of mutuality of being humans together. One of the beautiful things about we've learned in attachment studies is that we only get it right the first time about 33% of the time. This is Ed Tronick's work. And all the rest is rupture and repair. And I think as we come together in this mutual state of being human beings, we become humble enough so that when we have ruptures, we're able to recognize them and able to make the repairs, which are really the essence of secure attachment. It isn't just getting it right all the time. It's the ruptures and repairs that create resilience and security. So I think we have to come from that humble place inside ourselves first before we can really offer the fullness of our being to our courageous people, and that they can offer then in return the fullness of their being. And that's where healing happens.
Yes. And that flows into the second part of your book on practical matters. And you have a chapter there titled Through the Lens of Diagnosis. And there you talk about depression, anxiety, dissociation, and addiction. How does this new information about the brain inform us about these diagnostic categories? And does it bring anything new to our understanding of diagnosis or have implications for treatment?
Well, yeah, I think it does. Actually, this chapter is kind of funny. It really brought this back to me. This was not originally in the book, and Alan Shore, one of the, you know, one of the most brilliant men on the planet, and was one of the founding editors of this interpersonal neurobiology series with Norton, and he required me to write this chapter.
Interesting.
I don't ordinarily think about diagnosis very much. I'm just with people.
Yeah.
But I think this really helped me deepen into the common pathways that are there for all of these diagnoses, which all, unless there's a genetic component, are all arising usually with roots in early injury. And that we can begin to see how we can be with people as we understand that they aren't so much distinct things, but they're different manifestations that, for whatever reason, our system is using in that moment as a way to deal with the pain inside, that they're all coping strategies. They're all protectors in some way. And so that was really helpful for me. So if you read through that chapter, you begin to sense, well, it's all the same thing. It's just different ways of protecting, whether it's depression or anxiety or dissociation. And then, you know, kind of the outcome of all that is, I can't stand this pain, so I'll go towards something addictive to try to manage it.
Okay. You talk about the need to ground therapy in the right brain. Maybe you could give us a case example of grounding therapy in the right brain.
I think that probably the best way for me to answer that is I tried to think of a case example. It's like, well, there's nobody I work with where this isn't what's going on because it's all I do. So I thought maybe instead I would say a little bit about how each session begins, because if we can move toward that, if it's possible for me to be in as available a state to receive the person exactly as he or she is in the moment without any agenda or judgment, our nervous system experiences that as safety. And that allows the person to open internally to whatever needs to happen next. So before each time I'm about to open my door to welcome someone in, I go through a little, and I can do it very rapidly now, a little meditation exercise of grounding my feet, coming up and being with my muscles, my belly, and my heart, all of which are making connections to my skull brain, taking a couple of breaths, and then opening into what we call a bowl of receptivity. And then with that sense of open chest, open heart, open the door, and just be with whoever, whatever part of them has come in that day. That, to me, is where we begin. And if we can begin that way, our clients can step into safety, and their brains, their embodied brains, know what to do next when that's there. Mm-hmm. Feel so grateful to Steve Porges for his work on the nervous system. It has illuminated so much for me and anybody who's around me in terms of what safety actually is and how to be present in that way.
Wow. That kind of leads into my next question. I've been doing a whole series of interviews focusing on mindfulness, which, as you know, is a very hot topic these days. And you have a chapter titled The Three Faces of Mindfulness. What are the three faces?
Well, and again, there's probably 87 faces, so this is a small sampling. But
okay.
But for me, it begins with what I've called ordinary mindfulness. And by that, I just mean being attentive to my own inner state, and again, open to whoever this person is who's coming in right now. One of the acronyms, you know, Dan loves acronyms, and one of his is COAL, which is, I can't even think of exactly what it is right now, but it's basically opening a loving, compassionate space for a person. And that when that's there, the person feels, again, safe enough to begin to really settle into the therapy. So that, to me, is what I would hope I'd be able to extend to any human being, whether it's a bank teller or my daughter or my dog, you know, on an ordinary basis, that's our a gradually developing ordinary state of mind, is that receptivity. And then the second phase is what I just called, for lack of a better word, daily mindfulness, which means beginning to help my people, my courageous people, as they come in, begin to attend more and more to their own felt sense experience in their bodies. So we practice that a lot together. Someone might come in and begin to talk about something painful that's happened, and what they'll hear from me very quickly is, and where do you feel that in your body? And can we just be there with that? Can we just be with that sensation in your body and see what it would like to show us? So that to me is like a daily mindfulness practice of beginning to just be more attentive to what's happening in this moment, which often is a result of what happened way back when, but still lives in our bodies as a lived experience today. And just noticing it, I think we get into relationship with it in a way that it begins to calm and regulate a bit. So that's daily mindfulness. And then I've had some clients that actually have asked for specific mindfulness practices, and I'm willing to do that. I've been meditating for a long, long time, and there's a lot of different ways we can approach what for them might be a formal practice. But that is that's just a few people. The majority of the work is around ordinary and daily mindfulness, and then, you know, other practices can come in if they want to.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated to discover that you have chapters on both sand play and the integration of art into psychotherapy. And I've interviewed lots of Jungian analysts in this series, and I tend to associate those sorts of interventions with that theoretical orientation. And I have no doubt of its effectiveness, but what's brought you to include them in your brainwise approach?
Well, in the tradition of stealing from everyone with great respect, back in 1993, I went with one of my fellow clinicians to a play therapy conference and saw an old nun present on sand play therapy, and the hair stood up on the back of my neck, and it was like, oh my goodness, this is really important. So we went back to our agency, we bought a bunch of cheap toys and some plastic bins, and three of us at the agency began to do trays together just to see what would happen. And we were blown away by the depth of stuff that came up for us that we couldn't even name, but of the changes that we felt in our physiology. I had felt like this dark sludge kind of hanging out in my belly. I didn't know what it was from or what it was about, but I began to just focus on that when we would do the sand play. And over the 6 months, it lifted and went away. And I realized later that was my mother's depression sitting in my belly.
Wow, wonderful.
So we had these unbelievable experiences with it. So then, without further training, we had the temerity to begin to bring it in to all of our rooms. Every room in the agency had sand play availability, from little kids to adults, and began to see that if we could hold an open space, people could begin to explore in ways that they couldn't otherwise. And then eventually, coming out of experience into theory, began to realize that, of course, all of our early attachment experiences are not available to words. The first 12 to 18 months of life, we don't even make explicit memories. We only make implicit embodied memories. So there's really no way that can come into the therapy room except as acting as in the relationship between therapist and client or through nonverbal means. So we have found this to be such a rich way to explore this, and it's different than the way a Jungian approaches it, and I have huge respect for what they do. And at the same time, even without all that, without the formal training, we have found that our courageous people find amazing ways to use this modality to be with, for us to hold together these early attachment experiences in particular. Just to give you one example, I had a woman come in who's had a pretty tragic early time with her mother dying very shortly after she was born, and having a father that really didn't know what to do with her, and his parents didn't really know what to do with her either. So she had very, very little early attachment. And I will never forget this one tray where she put this tiny little bear with one little flower in the very center of the tray and just began to weep.
Mm.
And I just felt moved to put my arms around the tray from one side, and she put her arms around the tray from the other side, and we just held hands on around this baby and just sat there in tears and silence. I had some tears too, and just sat there and held this little one. And it was like a major turning point in her beginning, in a felt sense way, to acknowledge the depth of loss that she'd had in life. So that wasn't just an idea, it was an experience.
Oh, that's so sweet. What a beautiful example.
Yeah.
And you know, you mentioned attachment theory, and something I meant to ask you about earlier is that attachment theory actually predates all of this recent explosion of research on the brain, and yet the two seem to map one another so incredibly well.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think there's been so many people that have just intuitively been able to resonate with their courageous people and begin to understand what was going on inside long, long, long before we had any kind of science behind it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really beautiful. And so, you know, Bowlby's initial work on attachment and Main and Hess and all of those guys were able to observe through behavior that something was happening here in the relationship between parent and child. They could see it in the behaviors and the way that these people were together. And then more research on how this is so challenging later on in life if our attachments weren't so good. And so we could observe it through behaviors, but now we have ways of also understanding what it is that's happening in the brain around all of this. And so we've been able to follow the pathway deeper inside, and that maybe this gives us an even deeper compassion for what the losses were, even at a brain level, and how our own more integrated brains, which brings us back to therapist mental health, how our own integrated brains can begin to step in and be able to offer what we needed as babies that we didn't get when we didn't have parents that had these integrated brains, and that it's always possible to go back and mend.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, what you've just said really affirms that there are two really important paths to learning or to knowledge, and one is the path of observation and intuition and you know, figuring things out, if you will. And the other is the kind of that scientific exploration of the brain. And it's not that one way is the right way to the exclusion of the other.
Well, no. And there's a beautiful thing happening in the research now. We're beginning to move away from so much focus on what one part of the brain does. Not that that isn't interesting. So it's really... important that we value those. And you had referred me to look at, I can't remember her first name, Conwisher's TED Talk, which was very interesting. And she was pinpointing specific areas of the brain that do specific things, and that we can know this because when those regions are hurt, we lose those capacities. And that is interesting. But really what's true, even to me, a more overarching truth, is that it's really all about how these regions play together.
Yes.
That let us be the people that we are, and to be able to understand connectivity and which areas work with which areas to create this unbelievably rich subjective experience that we have no idea how neural firings can create, you know, our ecstasy at the smell of a rose, you know. So there's just so much mystery in all of it as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. You have a chapter where you talk about flow, you know, after dealing with the specific kind of parts and anatomical structures and so on, where I think you sort of begin to develop to try to communicate to the reader a sense of what you've just said, that it's really the pattern of interactions.
Right. And to know that, you know, with different people beginning to explore that, it isn't always more connectivity that's optimal. This is from Ian McGilchrist's work on the divided brain. He's after Dan's book, I would say he has been the most influential person for me just in the last couple of years. I hadn't read him when I even wrote the second book, so he's become a strong focus for me. But what one of the things he notes is that the two hemispheres of the brain are actually wired more to inhibit one another than to join. And that if you get an overjoining of the two hemispheres, you can wind up with a kind of schizophrenic experience. So there are parts where optimal connection is less rather than more, but that the brain, you know, kind of knows how to seek that optimal range of connectivity.
Yeah, so
fascinating to me.
Yeah, I had the privilege of interviewing him too, and I love having you replay some of these people back to me and reminding me of what they said and what it's about, because I just kind of keep moving on from interview to interview and really don't get enough time to kind of review it all.
Well, Ian's work, I think, on the two hemispheres is really, really ground-shaking for all of us if we can persevere, as he would say. As he says with his book, The Master and His Emissary, he said, if somebody handed me this book, I wouldn't read it. It's too big.
Right.
I got to interview Ian, too, and it was just a delightful experience. And but his perspective on, again, the right hemisphere perspective on the world being one about immediacy and in the moment and in the in-between and in the relational. And that when a society begins to move away from that and get locked into the left hemisphere, which is about reprocessing and mechanism and about creating systems, but no relational awareness, that when we get moved in that direction, we're in real trouble. And the research suggests that about 75% of us, I think in response to how scary and overwhelming the world is, have shifted left now. And that means it's really hard to get into a state of being present, truly present in the world from a right hemisphere perspective. And that's why I'm writing the next book, is about that.
Yeah, let's talk about that. And prior to turning on the microphone and the recorder here, you mentioned that you have kind of, you're working on another book and that you've got new ideas. So tell us about those.
Yeah. Well, and again, built on both of the other books and their basic orientation toward relationship, but now really having developed a concern that there are aspects even of the culture that are traumatic at this point. The amount of information that's flooding us. Somebody, I forget who the researcher is, but 174 newspapers worth of information flooding through us every day. And in addition to that, so much of it is about suffering that in order not to feel all that, a lot of us are having to just disconnect in various ways, whether it's through, you know, all the devices that we use and those kinds of things are just shifting out of the right hemisphere relational circuitry so that we don't feel so much. The left doesn't feel the way the right does. The right feels the suffering. Mm-hmm. So becoming concerned that our culture itself is traumatic in some ways. And how does that influence how we are as therapists? How is the culture influencing us? Especially with all this protocol and interventions and skills and all these kinds of more left hemisphere rather than relationally based treatments, evidence-based stuff, how are we losing the relationship? So that's one piece of it. And the other is I'm doing year-long trainings now here in Portland where people come for 3 days, four times a year. And at the beginning of these trainings, we all talk about how important it is to us to be present. But what I hear at the end of the year is, gosh, when I came in, I didn't even know what presence meant. Because we spend the year deepening into the capacity to be truly present to our clients.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my work now. So the new book is called The Heart of Trauma. Maybe the subtitle will be The Healing of the Embodied Brain in the Context of Relationships.
Well, I think maybe it would be good if we could have another conversation after that book comes out.
I would love that. I've enjoyed this so much.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad. Is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know before we hang up?
Well, I guess I just want to, again, express so much gratitude for the work of, in particular, Dan Siegel, Alan Shore, Lou Cozzolino, Marco Iacoboni, Steve Porges, and Ian McGilchrist. For me, they have been the giants on whose shoulders I'm privileged to stand. And I just feel just so close to them in certain ways because of deepening into their work over the years and wanting again to make it available to people. I was a lit major for bachelor, master's, and a doctorate. And so I love writing. And I think it gives me the opportunity to say things maybe in a way that people can hear them maybe a little more easily than going straight to the horse's mouth sometimes.
Yes, yes.
And that to me is a real privilege to be able to do that.
Yes, and as a result, I think you've made a really significant contribution. So, Dr. Bonnie Badenoch, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
I thank you for inviting me, David. I'll look forward to doing it again sometime.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Okay, Eric, it's good to have you here again.
Yeah, great to be back.
And so I wonder what impressed you, what stands out for you in this interview with Dr. Bonnie Badenoch.
Well, what a great experience and such a wealth of information. You know, my immediate reaction after the interview here is that I want to find out more about this topic as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, and I find brain research and this neuroplasticity and a lot of stuff that's happening today so fascinating.
Yeah, I think the world is really changing, and that is changing for young people who are planning to become therapists. Are you planning to become a therapist?
Yes, I am.
I've probably asked you that before.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I really think that in addition to all the Jungian and depth psychology stuff that you have to get under your belt, that you and other students are going to have to, one way or another, master this kind of material that we're talking about, because it's coming up in so many of these interviews.
Yes, it is. I find it equally important to be up to date on contemporary research.
Yeah. I think one of the best things that you could do, actually, would be to go through her workbook that's really designed to take you on that trip. And you may not be you may be overwhelmed by being in school right now, but I would keep that in mind maybe for later.
Absolutely. You know, just flipping through it really quickly, I can see the value in this workbook here. So it's definitely on my list, perhaps at winter break.
Yeah, also she's in Portland, you know, and she does these workshops. She calls it year long, but it's basically sounds like it's 4 weekends. And so that might be something to think about among all the other wonderful workshop opportunities that are out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Portland, that's not too far. You know, it's accessible.
Yeah, right.
Sure.
Definitely. Was there any part that you have questions about or that you were confused by?
Well, I'm familiar with the basics of attachment theory, and that's okay. Something that I'll be going back through. And, you know, I've made some notes about things that I'd just like to know more about and have a better understanding of.
Sure.
So when you asked her the question about attachment theory, she got a great answer there.
Yes, she did.
And it would...
I had asked her about how attachment, or I remarked that it has been amazing to me to see how well attachment theory, which was developed prior to all this brain research, how well the two map together. And I was really impressed by her answer, which was basically, I think, saying that the early attachment theorists who were therapists were describing what they were seeing in therapy and kind of figuring out what was going on. And so we shouldn't be so surprised that it turns out that there are analogs that are appearing, you know, in the brain.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you probably have a whole... many interviews on this very one topic.
Oh, definitely.
Very lengthy conversations.
Yeah, and it comes up, you know, it's already come up in quite a few interviews, which makes it, you know, partly why I wanted to bring it up with her.
I also like her emphasis on right brain, on the right brain part of things.
Yeah.
You know, with emphasis on relational aspects.
Yeah, that was a good reminder to hear that from her and her relating it to McGilchrist. Mm. And because I'd forgotten that piece of it. And there was a period in the early 70s where there was a lot of talk and excitement about the two hemispheres of the brain. Mm. And the ways that they were characterized, that the two hemispheres were characterized, which I won't go into now, but they didn't hold up over time. They were a little too simplistic, that the right hemisphere was kind of creative and that the left hemisphere was very logical and verbal and so on. And I think a lot of the subsequent research painted a picture that the relationship is far more complex than that. And I was tempted to challenge her at first, to challenge her on her characterization of the right brain. But, you know, I think she's up enough on all of this that I don't think, you know, I decided that I shouldn't challenge her.
I like how she described the relationship between right and left as being much more oppositional than we might think.
Yeah, where she was talking about, again, drawing upon McGilchrist's work, that part of the function seems to be to suppress and filter out communication rather than total two-way communication. And I've always been impressed by a similar idea that our senses are actually, instead of just being windows onto the world, as we think of them as windows onto the world, that from Robert Ornstein years ago, somebody who wrote about the brain, an MD, that they are as, our senses are as much as anything filters of the world, because there's a lot of stuff out there that we don't perceive.
All right.
But that's real, you know, like all other forms of radiation that our senses don't pick up, all sorts of smells that our noses aren't strong enough to pick up on, and so on. And so that's an interesting thought, that if we could perceive everything, it would be more than our brains could handle, and we would be totally overwhelmed. And so it seems to me that he's talking about something similar going on between the two hemispheres of the cortex. And with that, that's all I'm sticking with that and ready to call it a day. How about you?
Sounds good to me.
Okay.
Hello, Dr. Dave and listeners of Shrink Wrap Radio. This is Paul Kraus. I'm a licensed professional counselor in Tempe, Arizona. I decided to subscribe to donating $5 a month to Shrink Wrap Radio Podcast. I like to take my friends out for coffee about once a month, and so I thought, why not take Dr. Dave out to coffee once a month? We've been spending so much time together via the podcast that I just wanted to show my appreciation. So I would encourage you all to think about it next time you're at a coffee shop. If you spend somewhere around $5, why not give Dr. Dave a $5 endorsement every month?
Thank you, psychotherapist Paul Kraus, for that call to action. But don't wait until you're in a coffee shop. Seize the moment. Do it now, and you'll be glad you did. In fact, let me give you a little added incentive. If you will click on our multicolored support button in the right-hand sidebar and sign up for an ongoing donation of $10 or more, and indicate that you're responding to my book offer, I'll send you a brand new copy of one of the two books by Dr. Bonnie Badenoch that we discussed today. So just let me know if you want the main book or the workbook, and I'll rush them right out to you. I'm happy to announce that we have a couple of new transcripts on the site for free, cost you nothing. First, we have number 216, The Light in Dark Times with Michael Mead, thanks to Jill Ebsworth. And what a wonderful storyteller he is, and that's such an important one that somehow did not get transcribed, and Jill has made up for that. So thank you again, Jill Ebsworth. And we have a much more recent one that's a transcript of number 416, Trauma and the Soul, with Dr. Donald Calshed, and that's thanks to Paul Vignola. So thank you very much, Paul. I have a funny story about Audible.com, which, as you probably know, I've been promoting in recent episodes. And if you've been listening lately, you also know that I'm a fan of the Scandinavian genre known as Nordic Noir. Well, just a day or two ago, I finished reading Bad Blood by Arne Dahl, and I wanted to go back to the wonderful series by Jussi Adler-Olsen. I had already read three of his books and wanted to read the next one in the series, so I went right on to audible.com and grabbed the fourth one in the series, which is titled Journal 64. Then, the next day, I'm off on a car trip with my wife, and she suggests I put on my latest novel. So I started it playing through the car speakers, and to our shock, it was all in Swedish, which, by the way, neither of us speak. Well, we got a good laugh out of that. I didn't even realize that Audible was listing books in other languages. So if you understand Swedish, that will be good news to you. I'll need to look more carefully in the future. I think this must be a new thing for Audible, offering books in languages other than English. As you've heard me say, I'm a longtime Audible listener, and I've never encountered that before. So I called Audible right away. Their phone number is right on their website, and they have great support. I explained my mistake, and they added the credit back to my account. No questions, no hassle. And I was sure that it was going to go smoothly anyway. They're a good company. By the way, last Christmas, my wife gave me a gift subscription of 12 books. And I don't have to use it up in a year, and I don't have to do it at the pace of a book a month. So it's very flexible. It's one of the best gifts she's ever given me because I've gotten probably more than 100 hours of enjoyment from it. So to wrap up my story, they don't have the fourth Jussi Adler-Olsen book in English, but they do have the fifth one, which is called The Marco Effect. So I've moved on to that one. Don't forget, you can get this audiobook for free or any other one of your choosing with no obligation to continue your subscription by going to audibletrial.com/shrink.
Hi, this is Dr. Jeffrey Raff, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Jeffrey Raff. He's not my next guest, but as I mentioned last time, I could use some fresh transitions. So how about recording your own version of You're on the Couch with Dr. Dave so that we can have more variety? Now let's turn to some recent email from our listener community. I received a number of emails stimulated by my account of my struggles with whether or not to put a substantial amount of shrink wrap radio behind a paywall. I mentioned this in my last podcast and also in the last newsletter. As I hope you know, I ultimately decided not to take that step, but to continue to count on your voluntary generosity. The first one is a response to our last newsletter, and it is from Andre in South Africa, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. Greetings from South Africa. Thank you for your wonderful work that you are doing. With respect to the paywall issue, I believe that there is a third way that will allow you to continue providing your content in the donation format as well as bring in appropriate funding that will allow you to reach a wider audience and to grow this legacy beyond its current confines." And he urges me to watch a TED.com presentation given by Amanda Palmer on the art of asking. And you can find that if you go to TED.com. And I did watch it. He goes on to say, "I believe that Amanda Palmer's journey goes beyond the transactional dictates of a monetism, or I would say monetization, toward the truly numinous field of transformation through worth and financial interactions. If you do choose to view the talk afterwards, you can just go to the same place that she did to make it happen." And he gives the website address for Kickstarter.com. He goes on to say, "It would also be great if there was an Android app for your show. I am of the firm conviction that this would bring your work to a far greater audience, and I would personally love the convenience of being able to load the talks directly onto my tablet. Yours transpersonally," and that's from Andre in South Africa. Well, Andre, thanks for your very supportive email. I did go ahead and watch the TED.com video by Amanda Palmer on the art of asking, and I recommend it to all who are listening now. At the heart of her presentation is her urging us to overcome the shame of asking and trusting others to respond. So I feel that I have been doing exactly that and will continue to do so. She, as a musician with a band, she also used Kickstarter to appeal for help and got over $1 million. Now, I'm aware of Kickstarter, and it has never occurred to me to use it for Shrink Wrap Radio. I'll take a closer look at their requirements and consider giving it a try, but I'd be very surprised if it worked for my particular enterprise. And also, I would not expect people who are strangers to support Shrink Wrap Radio. I think the people who are most likely and who are appropriate to support Shrink Wrap Radio are those who listen to it, such as those of you who are listening right now. And finally, in response to Andre, I'm shocked that you are not aware that there is an Android app for Shrink Wrap Radio already. It's been there for some time. I can only guess that you're listening to the interview, but not the later parts of the show where I regularly announce it. But let me tell you again, and I hope that you do hear this, to get the information, just go to the Apps tab on the Shrink Wrap Radio website, and you'll get all the info right there. Next, we hear from Wendy, who also responded to the last newsletter with the following. Hi, Dave. I enjoy listening to your interviews, and like the reader whose letter you shared, I like to download the program and listen to it while I mow the lawn, metaphorically speaking. Smiley. I have been working on building a membership site for a while, so I would like to share a few thoughts that may be helpful. You wrote, quotes, I was always troubled that moving to a paywall scheme would be a violation of an implicit contract with my listeners, that changing the terms after 9 years would feel almost like bait and switch, close quote. She goes on to say, I agree, don't change the rules. Free is free. And free content gets you SEO, that's search engine optimization, and that drives traffic to your site. But if you don't have a way to convert that traffic into revenue, then what you're doing is a hobby. My guess is that you need to get paid so that you can continue to offer the high-quality content we've all come to appreciate. There's nothing wrong with that. So here is something I learned from Brendan Burchard that I think I'm going to implement myself. He goes on to say, continue to give away the content for free. Offer a membership option that offers additional benefits. For example, 1, members get an email notification whenever new content is added to the site delivered to their inbox. 2, members get a PDF report, for example, transcript. 3, members get bonus content that is not available to the public. For example, the best of compilation, your guests will have content they can offer, your membership exclusive gifts, reports, audios, videos, discounts on books, programs, etc. 4, you can also offer a closed Facebook group where members can interact with one another, discuss specific topics, and connect with you. As you can see, it's not about putting Shrink Wrap Radio behind a paywall. It's about offering more choices of how your listeners/readers consume what you're offering. It's offering more content, more convenience, and a higher level of participation. And seriously, $10 a month is what? A latte at Starbucks, a ticket to the movies. So I have to wonder, who is your audience? What is their time worth? I'm all for try before you buy. Donations are a socially conscientious approach, but monetizing isn't a sin. For many of us, it's a retirement plan. As I see it, you can continue to invite the public to donate for the same services you have always offered them, and you can offer something new, a higher level of service, convenience, and participation. I'm just saying. Warmly, Wendy. Okay. Wendy, thanks for taking time to write with these very practical suggestions. I'm aware of the approach you're advocating, that is, of charging for bonus content. I haven't followed that course because, honestly, it would mean more work for me to create that bonus content, and it's all I can do to produce the for-free content that my listeners have come to expect. If I were my younger, more energetic self, I'd jump on the project. Also, I've taken a couple of stabs at having a discussion group for the show. I think we had a closed Yahoo discussion group. I didn't have the time or energy to moderate it myself. Over the period that it ran, we had one or two listeners slash volunteers moderate it, but we had a little discussion for a bit, and then it would peter out. My conclusion is that either I don't have a large enough community for the critical mass needed for such a discussion group, or that it would require more interaction from me personally. And again, that translates to more work for me, which is something I'm trying to avoid. Finally, here's one more response to the newsletter, this one from Molly, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I don't listen to the podcast with regularity. Instead, I listen as I have time, sometimes three or four in one week, then none for several months. I love your interviews and thoughtful commentary. I'm especially drawn to your interviews with Jungian analysts, but honestly, I'm grateful that you cast a wider net than that. You helped me to expand my own horizons. I have donated in the past, but I just made a small contribution, and I will continue to make more as I am able. I love it that this contemplation as to whether or not to charge for your content has helped you to return to your center. It is so obvious that you follow your passion. Thank you for all you do. My very best." And that's from Molly in Richmond, Virginia. So I think I better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to emails, you can leave comments about individual shows, and you can leave voicemail on our new message phone. Well, it's not so new now, but it's 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone and Android app, about which you can find full details in the apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Bonnie Badenoch for sharing her work on becoming a brainwise therapist. I had an interview lined up for next week, but I had to reschedule for personal reasons, and I have not heard back yet from my guest, so at this point, I'm not sure what's going to be up next. But whatever it is, I hope that you're up for a surprise. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.